This is the Edisto TV podcast, connecting the Blackwater region.
Welcome to episode 14 of the Edisto TV podcast. I'm Hugo.
And I'm Tom.
And we are back. This week, we're going to devote most of the podcast to an interview we did a couple of days ago with Aaron Kilpatrick. That's Dr. Aaron Kilpatrick of USC Sockahatchie. And Tom, you found Aaron. I think you met him at a birding function of some description. Is that right?
That's right. We were at the Santee Birding and Nature Festival down in Santee and met Aaron and found that he was a wealth of knowledge about birding and natural resources and so forth. And I thought, well, he's in our area down at USC Sockahatchie, and he was willing to talk to us. So it turned out to be a great interview.
It really was. I enjoyed it. We talked for about an hour and a half. We'll probably be able to cut that down to 40 or 45 minutes for purposes of the podcast. So this one may run a little long as we pack in a whole bunch of Aaron Kilpatrick. Really enjoyed the conversation, and he has made rash promises to go out and explore some of the Edisto with us. So we'll have that to talk about in coming months. What's up on the internet this week, Tom?
Well, the EPA is beginning their cleanup of the Admiral Superfund site, the Admiral Appliances Superfund site down in Williston. This was a polluted area that flowed into Spur Branch in Williston, which flows directly into the South Fork of the Edisto. So those who are following the Edisto River and concerned about conservation have an opportunity to go to that meeting. There's a public meeting Monday, August 25th, which will be already passed by the time we get this podcast up. But anyway, we're going to kind of keep an eye on this. I understand you're planning to go.
I am. Chris Hall, who we talked to a few weeks ago here on the podcast, asked me to go out there with him, and I'm also interested in it for purposes of the Edisto Expeditions movie project. So we'll be there for the EPA hearing. That's tomorrow as we record this, but on Monday the 25th over in Williston, and we'll have more to say about it once we know more about it from having been over there.
Right, and then the other thing was some of the pictures that you took, some amazing photos, I thought, from your trip down the river. Could you just take a minute? I mean, the pictures were amazing. The little blue heron was great, and then this snake eating a catfish. I've just never seen anything quite like it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your trip down to Edisto the other day?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Unfortunately, you weren't able to join us. Originally, you were going to, but you had another commitment come up. But along with three other people, Scott Brome, who we paddled with and talked to on the podcast before, Joe Woodard, who has been a collaborator of mine on the Edisto project, amongst other things, and a good friend, Mark Calcagni, from up above Charlotte, came down to paddle with us. We put in at Mars Oldfield Landing and went around the big right turn down to Givehands Ferry. And right there where the river turns to the right is where Four Hole Swamp comes in. Probably the most outstanding portion of the trip for me was before we got started, I was telling everybody how I had heard that sturgeon jump there where Four Holes comes in. And as we came down the river, I turned to Scott and said, "Is that Four Holes coming in?" And he said, "Yeah." And we both turned to look. And at least 4 feet of sturgeon at that point jumped out and elevated above the water 3 or 4 feet, made an almighty big splash. I didn't get the picture, but it was awesome. I'm glad I saw it.
Yeah, we'll go back down there again and get some pictures. That sounds like an amazing experience.
It was something to behold. And we talked a little bit with various people about why it is that sturgeon jump. And there are various theories about cleaning parasites off their gills and mating this and that. It's my theory that sturgeon jump because they can.
Sure.
All right. So it was a great trip. I recommend it. The paddle down was very nice. They were in the process, actually, of doing some construction work on the takeout at Givehands Ferry. The ranger was nice enough to give us permission to use the portion of the takeout that was not actively under construction when we came down. But they'll be at that for a few more weeks, and then there will be a vastly improved takeout facility there at Givehands Ferry if people are interested in that. So it was a very nice paddle. Anything else on the internet front before we jump on into this interview with Aaron?
Nope, I think that's about it. Those are the highlights.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back here with episode 14 of the Edisto TV podcast.
Hey, this is Tom from Edisto TV letting you know a couple big things going on at Tyler Brothers. First of all, it's the end of summer clearance sale, so if it's a short sleeve, it's on sale. We've got savings up to 60% on various Carhartt and other clothing lines. And it's deer season, so that means cash back on rifles and shotguns from Browning and Winchester. Check them out online at tylerbrothers.net or visit the store in downtown Wagner.
And we are back on episode 14 of the Edisto TV podcast. Gonna jump right into that interview with Aaron Kilpatrick of USC Sacagawea. Dr. Kilpatrick's research expertise and interests are focused on the response of reptiles, amphibians, birds, small mammals, and vascular plants to forest management practices, including prescribed burning and other fuel reduction treatments. And he has conducted research in a variety of terrestrial and wetland habitat types in the coastal plain, Piedmont, and Blue Ridge physiographic provinces. Says so right there on his webpage from
That's
USC.
That's pretty impressive. That's a lot of words I don't know.
There you go. So I'm sure Dr. Kilpatrick does know all the words, and we're going to jump right into the interview with him talking about his upbringing along the South Fork of the Edisto.
Well, I grew up, spending a lot of time on the South Fork there around Aiken State Park. I grew up in Beech Island in Aiken County, which is, if you're familiar with that area, it's near Jackson and New Ellington.
I know it well.
When I was, after getting a driver's license, whatever, I would routinely go to Aiken State Park and spend a lot of time on the South Fork, and had lots of time on the Edisto throughout my life. When I was in high school, over a period of about three summers, I'd do these trips with my grandpa, Kilpatrick. And over a period of about three summers, we floated from Aiken State Park down to West Bank Landing in Jacksonboro. So we would do these like 5 and 6 day trips and, spend the night on the riverbank or wherever we could find a place to stay, and just met a lot of interesting people, but just saw a lot of the river, people don't get to see, the stretches that aren't close to any boat ramps, but it's a wild place, particularly the upper part. As far back as I can remember, I've always been interested in nature. So, as a biologist and college professor, it's sort of like, living a dream to do what I do, which is spend time in these natural resources and conducting research in these natural resources and teaching my students about these same things. So, that's what I spend most of my time doing is teaching about these things that we have and conducting research in these areas, primarily with reptiles and amphibians and vascular plants and birds. We're, of course, part of the USC system, one of USC's regional campuses, but I guess my point is it's a great opportunity to be, here in the low country, sort of centered in the low country in Walterboro and Colleton County, with, the Edisto on one side of the county, and then, of course, on the other side, you've got the Sacagawea River. So you've got this tremendous, outdoor lab, so to speak, where we can get lots of people engaged with what's going on. And I think a very important part of conservation is getting this information out there. It's one thing to conduct a study and get it published in a peer-reviewed journal, but I spend a lot of time on service opportunities. It's getting nature-based groups out to see this stuff and to talk about what we do and to talk about some of these issues.
Are you doing any? Is there anything in particular that you've been doing studies on lately?
I made a list of those projects we've worked on associated with the Edisto watershed over the last few years. So I did kind of jot a few things down for each of those projects and could just kind of quickly summarize those. And when you guys have any questions as I'm going along, let me know.
Yeah, that'd be very interesting.
One project that's still ongoing this is a long-term study that started in 2008, is part of setting up amphibian monitoring routes, primarily for calling frogs and toads. And we've got these routes all across the state, but a few of those are associated with the Edisto River watershed. One project that's still ongoing, this is a long-term study that started in 2008, is part of setting up amphibian monitoring routes, primarily for calling frogs and toads. And we've got these routes all across the state, but a few of those are associated with the Edisto River watershed. And this research is part of a national project called the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program, or just NAAMP, or NAMP for short. Like a lot of these different, you know, abbreviations for things. But anyway, we've been conducting these surveys for calling amphibians in South Carolina since 2008, all across the state. As I mentioned, we've got several on the Edisto River watershed. Primarily, and I'm thinking about routes specifically associated with the Edisto. For example, we have a route near Givens, that a route that parallels the river from approximately U.S. Highway 17A to South Carolina Highway 61. We've got a route in the Cattle Creek watershed near Bowman, and as you guys are familiar, Cattle Creek eventually flows into the Edisto. We have another survey route associated with the Four Hole Swamp watershed. So we go along at GPS locations, and we listen for calling frogs and toads on what's considered to be a good frog knot, you know, which includes, you know, some sort of rain to get breeding activity going. I guess the overall goal of our project is to really get an idea for what's going on with frog and toad populations across a broad region. So the study's, you know, much more than just a few samples at a local level. This is a statewide thing, and there's other states in the eastern U.S. doing the same thing. So we kind of get a regional idea for what's going on with breeding frog and toad populations, and not only in South Carolina, but across eastern U.S. with this program called NAMP.
So based on what you've seen, how's the frogs and toads doing?
Well, in the years we've been conducting this study, we've actually, well, I must say, you know, this program is, you know, South Carolina's, you know, long-term frog and toad monitoring program. And we've, you know, made a number of observations in terms of populations at the state level. Things appear relatively stable for, you know, those species that we're detecting. And of course, the thing to consider is, you know, what you're hearing on a given night is a lot of times based on weather. But the bottom line is, you know, we're in good shape in regards to, you know, frog and toad diversity in our state. We haven't noted any major declines in you know, in frog and toad detections since we've been conducting the study. You know, we know that amphibians are, you know, can be used as indicators of environmental quality. You know, we use amphibians to assess different things. So versus, you know, one species benefiting from all these frogs and toads, I like to think of it as, okay, we're out on the ground, we're hearing, you know, multiple species of frogs and toads calling, and as a result, for some parts of South Carolina, that's an indication of, okay, well, these the habitat components that these species need are intact enough for them to at least have calling males, and breeding is likely taking place, and chances are there's recruitment of young frogs of that same species. So I like to think of it as, you know, we've got this tremendous diversity of frogs and toads that we're detecting. We continue to detect it. So their breeding habitats, which are wetlands, are relatively intact and producing, new recruits for that species. You know, we've actually detected range extensions for a few species that have expanded their range, you know, since the late 80s and early 90s, and those would be, you know, tree frog species, for example. So we've learned a lot about, you know, range extensions. We've got new occurrence records frogs and toads that occur in the state, and then further information and support that this Edisto watershed, part of the Ace Basin watershed, and this area in general contains a tremendous diversity of frogs and toads. I mean, where we've detected 28 species of frogs and toads across the state, and the vast majority of those species occur in the coastal plain. But we are in a hot spot for frog and toad diversity when you think of the Ace Basin and this Edisto River watershed and the land associated with it. It is a frog and toad hot spot, and one that we pay close attention to, those that study reptiles and amphibians. I've got a colleague that's been conducting a biological inventory on a tract in Dorchester County for some time now, and that study is located at a place called the McElhaney Tract, which is near, I guess, proximal to Grover, South Carolina, off Wire Road. And this is a really unique area where we've studied reptiles and amphibians, and again, birds and plants. There's been about probably 3 bio blitzes conducted out there over the past 3 years, and we've learned a lot about this, the swamp forest habitat close to, adjacent to the Edisto River, and we learned a lot about a large oxbow lake habitat that's also associated with that track. So we've detected over 50 species of reptiles and amphibians, and some of those, with conservation status, like maybe salamander and the river frog and chicken turtle. So these species that do warrant some conservation status, we do find there. But it's a great example of mature forest habitat on the Edisto River, whereas, a lot of that forest habitat's been, either put in short rotation timber production. So it's unique to find mature forest like that on the river.
Seeing a lot of the river bottom get timbered, and a lot of it, like you say, is going back into planted pine trees and so forth.
Right.
From your perspective, how much pressure does that put on what remains? Because, you've got the monoculture issue in the pine plantation, and in general, I know, sort of runoff increases when things get timbered off. How much added pressure does that put on a blackwater system like the Edisto?
Well, it does put pressure on it. It puts pressure on the hydrology, because for some of these stands, even in floodplain forests, they're bedded and, planted in, as you say, a single species monoculture like loblolly pine. So that bedding and planting of loblolly pine affects the hydrology. And then when you start thinking about just floral and faunal diversity, say 5 to 10 years, or from year 5 to say year 25 in that stand, there's say from year 5 to 25, you do see a decrease in the diversity of flora and fauna in that stand. I mean, you essentially have a closed canopy. There's not a lot that can regenerate, under those pines. And with that limited overstory diversity and closed canopy, you see, reduction in plant diversity, and then associated with that, reduction in bird and other vertebrate diversity. So, there are some big differences between those stands that are in intensive silviculture and, let's say, a much older pine stand or a hardwood stand or mixed hardwood pine stand.
Can you speak to the value of a buffer or a larger buffer on the river?
I can speak to the value of a larger buffer. I mean, these riparian forests, that's a forest adjacent to this, these streams or rivers. Those are incredibly important migration corridors for birds. So when that gets reduced, there's that much less, corridor habitat for spring and fall migration. In addition to the risk that these really thin buffers have for windfall, when you take out a lot of that floodplain forest and you get a windstorm, there's just that little thin strip is at risk for you know, for these tall canopy trees just falling over in the river. You guys have probably seen that if you, you spend time floating the river. You get in these narrow buffers, and it seems like, you know, after a thunderstorm, you know, you see these tall trees that have been knocked over in the river. So just the ability of that thin buffer to withstand wind is put at risk. So you know, you lose some of those big canopy trees to windfall, I think, at a higher rate than you'd see if that buffer was much wider. So you do see things like that. You know, those floodplain forests are important migration corridors. They're of course important areas for reptiles and amphibians. So the harvest may directly influence those animals that are there. But the important point I was trying to make a minute ago is that, you know, it's hard to relate, you know, timber, you can't say that timber harvest is going to cause a decrease in everything. It's much more complex than that. My point was, you know, timber harvest definitely changes, you know, the structure of that habitat. Some species benefit, and some species don't benefit at all. So it's hard to generalize about, you know, the effect of timber harvest on, you know, just to say timber harvest has a negative effect on all reptiles and amphibians, and that wouldn't be true. In the same way for birds, there are some species that need that disturbance. You know, some species only breed in canopy gaps, and that can be caused by, you know, by, that can be a man-induced disturbance like harvest, or it can be a natural disturbance like a hurricane. So I just wanted to be clear about that. It's not an easy relationship just to generalize about when it comes to, you know, the effect of timber harvest on flora and fauna.
We'll be right back with more here on the Edisto TV podcast after this.
Hey, this is Tom from Edisto TV, welcoming our new sponsor, the Black River Chop House in Orangeburg, recently voted by the Times and Democrat as the best place for a cocktail, best place for nightlife. Check out the team over there at the Black River Chop House in Orangeburg Mall. Great place to go when you're thirsty, great place to go with some old friends, or go meet some new ones. Black River Chop House, quality food and spirits in the heart of Orangeburg.
And welcome back to the Edisto TV podcast. Let's jump right back into that interview with Aaron Kilpatrick. And he had something to say about Bachman's warbler, which I thought was very interesting. And he references here a classic book, The South Carolina Bird Life publication by Sprunt and Chamberlain. And we have a PDF that he sent us of the pages talking about Bachman's warbler, and I think those are going to be in the show notes. Is that right?
Yeah, those will be linked in the show notes. I'll have them up on the web, and yeah, pretty interesting stuff as far as, you know, history of who saw the Bachman's warbler, you know, how it was reported, when they saw it again. I mean, it's amazing, the history of this bird.
All right, so jumping right back into the conversation as we started talking about Bachman's warbler with Aaron Kilpatrick here on the Edisto TV podcast.
So does this mean that the Bachman's warbler is going to come back because we've got more edges?
what species?
Bachman's warbler.
I know.
Since I started on the Edisto documentary I've been working on, I've been keeping a close eye out.
Oh, I have. Yeah, for years.
Can you go ahead and just briefly fill me in on the history of Bachman's warbler?
Well, I mean, I'll give you the whole history, but I know that I think the last one spotted was in the 60s, 1960s, and, you know, it was a species when it was seen associated with switch cane breaks and, you know, dwarf palmetto in immature floodplain forest and along edges in those floodplain forests. So, but, you know, I can't tell you where, you know, exactly where the last ones were seen. I'm thinking that was, you know, Charleston County somewhere, but that, and much more than that, I just know that, there haven't been any records for that species in a long, long time.
The reason I'm fascinated with the Bachman's warbler is it was first collected along the Edisto by John Bachman and then given to Audubon, who described it.
Right, and I think I remember reading that in in that. There's a publication you may have at, you know, South Carolina Bird Life, written by Alexander Sprunt and a gentleman with the last name of Chamberlain, so who were avid birders through the 1930s and 40s. But anyway, there's a great account of Backman's Warbler in there. If you haven't seen that publication, I could figure out some way to get that information from this book to you if you wanted it. Backman's Warblers is described in there, along with some other long gone species like the Carolina parakeet and species like say the ivory-billed woodpecker. But all the last documented records are described in some fairly decent detail in that publication. It's a great book. I did an orchid study for green fly orchid at several places. One of our study sites was at Bobcat Landing on the Edisto. And I don't know if you're familiar with the green fly orchid or not. You may have seen some in your travels down the river possibly, but it's our only epiphytic orchid, you know, in the Carolinas. So it's the most northern ranging epiphytic orchid, or orchid that lives on another plant like a tree or a shrub. So
I seem to recall seeing them in four holes at the Audubon Forest up there, the Beadler Forest.
Yeah, that it's a common orchid, at Francis Beidler and Four Hole Swamp. So did a study with green fly orchid looking at, you know, sort of what kind of floodplain forest you find them in, what sort of wetland environments they occur in, what are the, you know, what host trees do they occur on. And one of the questions I was interested in would be, you know, when I first started finding that orchid years ago, I sort of associated it with really, really mature stands, kind of like what you see at Francis Beidler in Four Hole Swamp, you know, whether it's old growth swamp forest or swamp forest that's, you know, 100 plus, 200 plus years old. But after looking around, particularly in a wildlife sanctuary here in Walterboro, the Walterboro Wildlife Sanctuary, where the swamp forest is about, you know, as much younger, 50 to 60 years old, that species still has a way to colonize a stand even after it's been cut. I mean, it kind of makes sense that it could do that, but even as fragmented as our swamp forests are, that orchid has a way, the seeds have a way to find, find their way on the side of a tree in the middle of the forest and still, you know, germinate and produce another colony of orchids. So it's an amazing plant if you think about how it could get around in a swamp forest and how it can repopulate a stand that's been cut. Well, we had the orchid study there on the Edisto, and then I guess a couple other things to note would be, I take lots of groups out on what was called the West Faco Nature Trail for years in Jacksonboro. That's an incredibly unique area on the Edisto River, if you guys haven't been there.
Yeah, they've got a very nice boardwalk there, actually. My mom and I did that a few months ago.
Right, and it's a great example of mature floodplain forest, which, again, you don't find a lot of that. You can find some mature cypress tupelo swamp, yeah, but when it comes to, mixed pine hardwood forest adjacent to those swamps, those are kind of hard to find, you know, and that's what you have along that nature trail is really, you know, mature, you know, mixed hardwood pine forest with some really unique bird species like, we get Kentucky warbler in there. We get Swainson's warbler in that stand, along with some other interesting species. But it's a very unique area along the Edisto River.
Well, if you're able to tell the warblers apart, I want to go walk in the woods with you one day.
Well, let's go birding. Yeah.
I did want to, at some point, ask you to talk about what a Blackwater River is and sort of why it is what it is and what makes it special.
What makes a Blackwater River so would be where it originates. So streams, watersheds that originate in the South Carolina coastal plain are Blackwater Rivers. Another way to describe the Blackwater River is to call it a non-alluvial river or a non-alluvial watershed. And what that means is that these non-alluvial watersheds have their primary nutrient loads are organic nutrients. So in contrast to a watershed like the Savannah River or the Santee, which is considered a brownwater river or brownwater watershed, where the primary nutrients are inorganic, like silts and clays. So, you know, that tends to give the water a different color. And then that tends to give the soils adjacent to the soils in the swamp a different color as well. So Blackwater rivers are non-alluvial rivers. Primary nutrients are organic. And because those organic nutrients tend to kind of, you know, steep in along the swamps as that river meanders down the countryside, those organic nutrients, particularly tannins, stain the water and give it a tea color. So, and those are the criteria for, you know, Blackwater River.
One of the things that you find anytime you Google the Edisto is it's the longest free-flowing Blackwater River and choose your, you know, you hear the United States, you hear the southern Mississippi.
Right.
Why is free-flowing significant in terms of these non-alluvial rivers?
Well, free-flowing is significant for any river, but it's significant for a non-alluvial river. Take, for example, migratory fish. I mean, we've got species that move, you know, migratory species like sturgeon that are striped bass, shad, whatever they are, American eels that must, you know, move up these streams and rivers, and they did for millennia. And to not have that stream free flowing prevents fish migration is a major factor. The free flowing river has a characteristic hydrology that gets altered when a hydroelectric dam is installed along a river.
Under the current law, a particular farmer does have the right to take the last drop at his withdrawal point. And if a farmer, now these potato farmers we've been dealing with, they say they're never going to do that. And they drilled a well to make sure that they have a backup supply of water. So they could stop pumping. But if they're not required to do that by law, and if the next farmer came along and he chose to take every drop during that dry time so he could water his crops, what would the impact be to the river? Would that be devastating, or would that be okay?
Well, what happens if it's, you know, if it gets drawn down and there are these isolated pools, and that's probably what it would be like, these series of isolated pools down the river. Could it happen? Yeah, it could happen. It would impact the hydrology. How, you know, could we define it as devastating? I'm not sure. You know, as I mentioned, I gave some examples of the effects it'd have on various faunal groups. It would impact those groups. Yeah, it would. Downstream, how far? I mean, it's hard to tell because of all the other input sources for the watershed. But at that immediate site, there would be some impact. Yes.
We're not trying to take you to an extreme position. You're a scientist, and it's okay that we don't know. I think we all agree it's probably better not to take every last drop out. And I think hopefully Farm Bureau and the Department of Agriculture and everybody else is coming around to that viewpoint that, yeah, you know, we can't take every drop of water. Let's prevent that from happening.
It seems to me like, to answer that question, as I say, one could go to the literature. You know, and there's got to be some peer-reviewed studies, and I haven't reviewed the literature for this topic, but I mean, there's got to be some peer-reviewed studies where this has happened in other watersheds.
So that wraps up the conversation we had with Aaron Kilpatrick about the Edisto and his work in the Edisto watershed. I thought some of his perspectives on the water, surface water removal issues were particularly interesting.
Yeah, I mean, how much can the river take? That's the question that we're all asking is, you know, how much can a river take? And what happens if we take more than it can handle?
Yeah, know? And I felt a little bit guilty that we kind of pressed Aaron to say things about the situation that maybe he didn't feel entirely comfortable with. So there is a small portion of his responses there that sound vaguely like a hostage tape, but I think we made up afterwards.
Well, the thing is, he's a scientist, right? So he wants to see facts. And I think where we ended up was, you know, there's got to be some studies done on what happens if you do take every last drop. So we know the potato farm, you know, the Walthers, they've said they're not going to do that. They've drilled a well, so they have an alternative. But the next farmer who decides to take water out of the river, and they have a right to take every drop. And what happens if that happens? And so I think Aaron was not ready to say it was going to be devastating. He wanted to see some facts and data and see some studies. And so I think hopefully we never have to get any studies, because we're going to just change the law and then we don't have to really address this hypothetical situation.
Hope springs eternal. And with that happy note, we're going to call it a wrap for Edisto TV Podcast Episode 14. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Hugo.
We will see y'all next week here on the Edisto TV Podcast.
This is the Edisto TV Podcast, produced by Edisto TV, connecting the Blackwater region.